Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today to discuss the delicate topic of suicide and suicide prevention are three distinguished guests. John Madigan is Senior Director of Public Policy with the Suicide Prevention Action Network USA, a division of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Michelle Hunt is Chair of the Public Policy Committee of the Capital Region Chapter of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. And Mary Jo Gibson, wife of New York Congressman Chris Gibson, is one of four congressional spouses from across the country who are joining the cause by co-chairing symposia and other events to raise awareness about suicide. Gibson is a licensed clinical social worker and is a crisis intervention teacher. Thank you all for being here, John and Michelle, and of course, Mary Jo. Thank you for doing this. Let me start with you, Mary Jo, because I know you the best. And and the question is, why the interest? What motivated you to do this?
Okay. Well, first, thank you, Alan, for allowing us to be here, as well as Ian helping organize in WAMC, which we very much appreciate the effort of allowing us to talk. When I was in undergrad, undergrad in psychology and my master's in social work, and I interned at the time at an employment assistance program, and that was my first introduction in working even with grief. And I did some workshops for the employment assistance program so that they could understand about our service that we were providing. They allowed us to research a topic to then speak to the federal employees to let them know about our program. I chose the topic of grief and discussed the stages of grief according to Kubler-Ross. And that was the first exposure I had to in working in the area of grief. And I felt why I picked that topic was everyone experiences grief. You can't live your life without going through some form of grief. So I did those workshops, and then I saw clients who dealt with different issues. And later, after graduate school, I worked in psychotherapy, doing individual, couples, and group work, where I did deal with clients who had suicidal ideations. And after that, after we had our first child, and my husband and I with the military, I was 14 years a military wife, I did retire. I stopped working in the after our first child, and then went on to not work as a clinician, as a social worker, but rather volunteering my time assisting my husband with the military families, and the family readiness group was the term. And so in that experience, I knew a lot of the social workers, so when issues came up, I could refer them to social workers. But again, I was not working as a clinician. We did not experience suicide in our units that my husband was in at that time.
I think we should interrupt and just say your husband, Congressman Chris Gibson, was also, he was a colonel. I meant Major Small M, but Colonel Large M, and he saw major service around the world.
Yes, he rose to the rank of colonel. His last assignment was in the 82nd Airborne Division at Fort Bragg. So we came across, obviously, loss. We lost two soldiers in combat, and we had many injured. We had not experienced in our unit that my husband was in suicide, but I did come across it. And as you know, that's a major issue right now. Indeed. And is being well addressed, I want to say, by the military. They're doing many, many efforts to assist and normalizing treatment for people. And I think that's something we have to work towards. And as it relates to the military, we have to normalize treatment and understand that it's okay to reach out. It's okay to get help. And the more that the senior leadership encourages that, and the programs that they're doing in the military to identify those who are displaying suicidal ideations, the more that there can be interventions and they can get help. Now, currently, as my husband is in Congress, I met a gentleman named Eric Marcus, and he wrote a book, Why Suicide? His father had committed suicide, and he had written a book, and he's also on the Foundation for American AFSP, which is the acronym for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. I met him with my husband, and he wanted my husband to be aware that he'd be happy to assist if he comes across issues that as a resource, he would be available to talk. I then was in touch with him again after that, and he reached out to me and said that if I wanted to be a part of a spouses group in the congressional spouses group. And I said I was interested, and that if he could tell me more information, and I could be contacted by John Madigan, who later on reached out to me. And then he said to me, I understand you're considering co-chairing this group. I said, oh, okay. Now I've moved quickly. But there was no group at the time. And we started out as a bipartisan, two spouses from the House side, two spouses from the Senate side, Democrat and Republican spouses. And that interests me, to be working together to start to help in educating and advocating for those who've experienced, whether they've at risk or the survivors of suicide. So after some reflection, and I realized that, it was something I really wanted to be a part of, because it's a cause, we have a partnership that I feel like is a major cause that that was important.
Have you ever met anybody who's committed suicide later?
I have not.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're a remarkable person. That's probably why you went into social work, and that's probably why you, feel so passionately about this.
I also wanted to share that my sister is also a social worker, and she is on a coalition in California on suicide prevention, and she has created a program that educates teachers to identify suicidal behavior in children. So that the teachers can, and they have actually, Meryl Hemingway is the narrator, and it is in all the public schools and all the charter schools in California. So just to know, both my sister and I being social workers, that's just to have a better understanding of the broader impact. And so she's another resource and doing great work in this field. Just want to give you an additional background there.
That's great. Thank you for that. Michelle Hunt is the chair of the Public Policy Committee of the Capital Region Chapter of the American Foundation of Suicide Prevention. How come, Michelle? Why'd you take this on?
Well, suicide has touched my life in many ways. I lost both a family member and a friend to suicide. And I just want to mention a little bit about language. Well, kind of an aside here, that because words do matter. And one of the things that we do as a chapter and as a national organization is try to fight stigma. So we tend not to use the word commit, committed suicide, because it tends to make it sound like they did something wrong, bad, illegal, immoral. So we tend to say died by suicide or completed suicide. We also tend not to say successful, like a successful attempt or a failed attempt, because, of course, a successful attempt is not good. A failed attempt may be good. So we tend to be very aware of the words that we use, because even though we are advancing a lot, both New York State and federally, on getting access to mental health care through the parity laws, we need people to access. It doesn't matter if we have the best mental health services in the world if we don't get people to access it. And stigma is a huge issue.
So sorry, I don't want to give you a hard time, Michelle, but yeah. I do want to understand it. And that is, when we say somebody committed suicide,
yeah,
what's the stigma there?
Because committed sounds like committed a crime. It kind of sounds like there was people come choose suicide for, it's very complex, many different reasons, but we don't want to put that burden on, say, survivors or family members, and making it sound like that person failed in some way or did something wrong in some way. Of course, we hope that people don't make that choice, but we like to use terminology that's not as inflammatory.
Okay, see, I'll be honest with you. I don't see it as inflammatory, mm-hmm. but, people make their own choices in terms of the language they want used around their issues.
Sure.
And you're doing that. It seems to me that the big issue here is to get involved to the point where people will not do this. In fact, I believe it's being used as a verb now, suicide. And so I don't know that I have no quarrel with your language issues, but I really do think, I don't take out of it that it's a terrible word to say to people for whatever it's worth. But you said it was in somebody in your family did this thing?
Yes, I had a family member who died by suicide, and then a couple years after that, I lost a good friend. Mm-hmm. I also have struggled with my own mental illness that brought me to some very dark places that helped me to really sympathize with what somebody might be going through when they make that choice.
When you were in that dark place, did you consider suicide?
I did.
Mm-hmm. And how did you avoid it?
Well, when we talk about risk factors, we also talk about protective factors. And I was very lucky that even though I was struggling with mental illness, a major clinical depression, and we know that 90% of the people who do complete suicide have some sort of diagnosable mental illness at the time. I had several protective factors in place, including supportive family and friends who weren't afraid to talk about it, who weren't afraid to ask me outright. I also had good medical care access. So I had services in place that were supporting me, both medical and therapy-wise.
Okay. I want to go, if we can, to John. And John Madigan is Senior Director of the Public Policy of Suicide Prevention Action Network USA. John, what do you make of what you just heard?
Well, Alan, first of all, thanks so much for having us on your program. I think I wanted to say at the outset that volunteers like Mary Jo Gibson and Michelle Hunt really represent the front line, so to speak, in our fight to educate the public and to fight stigma around suicide. I've been involved in healthcare in one way or another for 35 years. I started out with the American Cancer Society back in the 80s, and then I was with the Alzheimer's Association in the 90s. I think all of us on this program right now are probably old enough to remember when people didn't talk about cancer in the 60s, or people didn't talk about AIDS in the 70s.
Sure,
or
I remember people saying, my relatives saying CA for cancer, because it was only too much.
Exactly.
To
you
say
remember that? Yeah. Right. So I joined the AFSP SPAN USA 3 years ago. I, too, am a survivor. Lost my sister to suicide 14 years ago. So my reaction to what Mary Jo and to what Michelle are saying is that they're both positive, hopeful people. And as part of my job here in Washington, D.C., to help direct the advocacy efforts here at the national level and in states across the United States, like New York, we have to educate people. And being an advocate's more than changing laws. It's about educating people and changing minds. And my Lord, for Michelle to get on a radio station like yours and to talk about her situation, so helpful to the rest of the listeners out there to hear that other people are facing similar situations and that there's hope and that there is help out there, and that's our message.
Do you know why your sister completed suicide, if I can ask?
Sure. I think in our case, my sister was 14 or 15. She was diagnosed, then it was called manic depressive, now it's called bipolar. And she lived with her disease for 15, 17 years. And then there was a bunch of things that happened to her. She got beaten up. She was a social worker, by the way. So she gave back to the community in Minneapolis, St. Paul. Her partner left her, and she had just my parents had just helped her buy a new home. So she moved into her new home on Friday, and she was dead by Monday. And the best we can figure out is she gave up. She stopped taking her medication with the two life-changing things, buying a new home and losing a partner. That put her into a different sphere. And as I said, all we can say is that she gave up and just couldn't live with the pain.
Okay, so let me go to Mary Jo and ask her. Mary Jo, obviously there are people at home who are saying, I may have thought about this once or twice in my life and, when times were tough. What are the things that we can put in place to make sure it doesn't happen, these specifics?
Well, an organization like this, and that we even have the number to give to people? Because if you're listening, you may want the number.
The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-TALK. 82255.
Say it again. 1-800-273-8255. Okay, so what do you want us to do? If somebody has these thoughts, suicidal thoughts, what are the specific things? If I'm contemplating this, I have not, but if I'm contemplating it, should I just get on the phone? Your phones would be pretty busy, because I think a lot of people have contemplated suicide at some point in their lives.
Well, one of the things that we want people to understand, because there's a myth out there that's pretty pervasive, that if you ask somebody about suicide, that you might put the idea into their head if they weren't thinking about it. And that is false. So the first thing that you need to do, if you are concerned about somebody, if you're seeing a change in behavior, a change in mood that's significant, that you do say the word. Don't just say, are you having trouble, are you having problems, but actually say the word suicide. Alan, I'm seeing these changes in you. Spell them out. Are you thinking about suicide? It's important to me, and this is important that we do something about it. Actually say the statement to the person. Even if you weren't thinking about it, would you be insulted if somebody asked you? Probably not. You probably would at least appreciate that somebody was concerned. So we really encourage people to start asking, because suicide is a public health problem and it really requires a community effort.
Yes, I was going to say, in identification, family sees differences, friends see differences. The more that people understand the signs of this suicidal, I'll say, ideations.
You keep using that word, and I'm so sorry, I'm not familiar with it. What is an ideation?
We'll have thoughts, suicidal thoughts.
Okay, okay.
And so if someone came in, I'll just say it as a clinician, if someone comes into the office, you would want to ask them, are they feeling suicidal?
Sure.
Do they have a plan? You assess their resources, their family resources, support. You have to do a very detailed assessment.
What do you mean, do they have a plan?
An actual plan to take their life.
Oh, I mean,
you, as a clinician, you have to assess all these things. And one of the two things you report is someone hurting themselves or harming someone else, right? So you need to assess where they are. And
are clinicians asked to report people with suicidal instincts?
You have to discuss it. You discuss it with your supervisor. You let them know that this is what this. You wouldn't have someone leave the office if you have, unless you have a clear understanding that they are not going to take their lives. And it's a very risky thing, because it's very challenging to do the right assessment. And there are many series of assessments that different, a school might have assessments, a clinician might have assessments, you know, but you must identify if they are having it. And you hospitalize. If you feel that they are going at risk of hurting themselves, they need to be put into a hospital setting to at least be evaluated for 24 hours. Mm. And then, so I think the education piece of knowing of others, the signs, and getting people to resources to go and reach out and know that they're not alone, that they need to reach out for help, whether it's a phone call, whether it's looking at a website, American Foundation, their website, and saying, oh, are there support groups? You know, because if they also, the survivor, they need a support group, which that is something that is provided there. And there are many wonderful agencies out there to help people.
Now, of course, we have talked about people who have some bipolar issues, but there are also people who come to that wall in their lives where something terrible has happened to them. Mm-hmm. A politician who has been caught stealing, and after a life of adoration. You know, we've had a couple of those cases in New York State recently. And they say, well, it's all over for me. I've blown it. My wife is not going to tolerate that. My children will be ashamed of me. I have no way out except suicide. That's a different situation than if somebody has manic feelings or is depressive. That's something else. Has anybody thought about that on this panel?
Well, it's also a crisis.
Yeah, sure, John.
Jump in.
Of course.
Yeah, I would argue that if someone, the example you just gave of a politician that's found doing something illegal or stealing money, they themselves, again, are probably depressed and have different issues that they're just not aware of. So I think the situation itself causes problems for people. And again, as Mary Jo and Michelle have talked about, it's all about reaching out to people, finding out where they are. So if you're a school counselor, or you're a captain in the Army, or you're a colleague at work, each of us have different responsibilities, and I think the bottom line is to ascertain, again, like Mary Jo and Michelle have talked about, ask them directly, are you considering suicide? And if they are, not just walk away, but figure out a plan with them, you know, get them to the proper medical care to get a further evaluation as to what has to happen. In some cases, I mean, I've read countless stories now. One of the major issues we're working on, of course, is with the Pentagon and the Department of Veterans Affairs. Some studies indicate that 60-70% of people, the first major thing you can do is sit down and just talk with them honestly about it. And then once you open that dialogue, that relieves some of the pressure in their minds, and they can cope with it, and then you can figure out something. 20-30% of people are in such serious shape that they do need immediate medical attention. So those are the kinds of things that Mary Jo was talking about, that medical professionals have to get involved and decide whether or not facility treatment is required.
John Madigan, have you ever done any of the things you're espousing other people do? In other words, you suspect somebody is having suicidal thoughts and you sit down with them. I'm trying to put a sort of a clinical look at this.
Yes.
You have.
Oh, absolutely. I understand your question. Yes, several years ago, I had a staff member of mine that was going through a messy divorce, and he was very concerned about his future. I noticed he was drinking heavily, or would come into work disheveled, and I finally called him into the office and asked him directly, you know, what was going on, if he needed help. At first he said no, he could handle himself, and then after about an hour's worth of conversation, we decided that he did in fact need help, and I accompanied him to the emergency room over at the George Washington Hospital here in town, and he subsequently got the kind of help that he needs. He's remarried now, has a family, and you know, for me, that's just one example of what people can do. But there are thousands of people like me across the country, people like Mary Jo, people like Michelle, that are doing the kind of work that needs to be done. And I think in this case, it really is one-on-one, people recognizing a change in a friend's attitude or behavior, or a loved one's you know, sleeping more, sleeping less, is not eating. There are countless signs. Again, if you go to afsp.org, there's all kinds of information on our website which will help people figure out pretty quickly what the warning signs are and what are some of the things you can do to have an immediate effect on someone that's seriously considering suicide.
So I guess with all three of you, what I'm interested in are the clinical signs that we should look out for. Now, obviously, maybe I'm naive, but I think that there are some times in somebody's life that they're more likely to be under this kind of pressure. John just mentioned somebody getting a divorce. We see at NYU a terrible spate of suicides, student suicides, mm-hmm. under tremendous amounts of pressure, you know, to do well, to excel, and for God knows what reason, we read about it in the tabloids the next day. So maybe we could get a little list of things or times in life that are most likely to lead to the kind of depression or the kind of anxiety that leads to suicide. Michelle?
Well, one of the things that you were just talking about colleges, and suicide is the second leading cause of death among college students. So it certainly is a population that we want to be concerned about. One part of our community that people tend not to think about is the elderly. Of course, there's a lot of loss potentially going on at that time and can cause somebody to lose hope, which might bring them to think about suicide. Currently, the largest increasing rate is amongst middle-aged. and possibly that sandwich kind of generation, getting pressure from both sides, maybe some economic reasons. We don't exactly know why, but...
Yes, I'm sorry to interrupt, but yeah. Do we know, and John, you could come in on this if you know, or Mary Jo, do we know that when we go through a spate of unemployment in the country, that suicide seems to be an option to some people who, you know, who want out?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that that can be a trigger, not a cause, but for somebody who's having maybe problems with depression or having underlying mental illness, that we can see that there might be a trigger like a divorce or unemployment or some other kind of tragedy that is a trigger that might cause someone to kind of move in that direction. One of the things that often happens is, and another myth is that people who are thinking about suicide are intent on dying. And a lot of times it's an impulsive decision that might be triggered by just something that happens, and that they are really ambivalent about death, but it's just that impulsivity that causes them to end up taking their life. So if you can keep somebody safe who you think is suicidal for that period of time to get them to resources, get them to reconsider, you can save a life. One of the things that we do talk about also is that means matters. Making people safe, removing pills, removing firearms. Firearms is the most common means of suicide
in this
country. And so removing firearms from a home can help keep somebody safe.
And of course, when you save a life, the three of you, when you save a life, you'll never have proof positive that you saved the life because they're still alive, right? I mean, they can say, I was going to suicide, but you'll never know because that person's still alive.
Well, you know, you look at the statistics, you look at what you know, and we just have to trust in what we do.
I would jump in back to your other question. There are some studies in Europe that show the downturn in the economy has had an impact on the suicide rates over in Europe. In this country, unfortunately, believe it or not, we do not collect yet in all 50 states information apple to apple on suicide deaths. It's something called the National Violent Death Reporting System. And right now, only 18 states collect that data. And even worse, we're dealing with data that's 3 years old. So we are now dealing with data from 2009. And I think it's fair to say that with the economic downturn in this country now we're starting to see the signs. I think it was Michelle that mentioned the suicide rates are increasing among people, Alan, your age and my age, white men over 50, who are facing the prospect of not ever working again. So I think, you know, there is some clear connections. Again, there are factors in what's going on. It's not the only thing causing it. But again, imagine losing your job. You can't pay your bills. That's probably going to trigger depression. And if you like to drink, you might drink more excessively. And then you might get into drugs. And if you live in a home that has guns, all the elements are there for a suicide. So that's, again, even more important that we recognize what's going on with family, friends, and colleagues, and really try to help them figure out what they need to do to get help.
You know, Joe, I think something John just said set you off. Is there something that you don't agree with?
No, I agree with what he's saying. It's 18 states, right, John, that currently
Correct.
Does that particular study. The statistics come from the Center for Disease Control currently for all the
yes.
United States.
But
the specifics that you're speaking of are in 18 states, and New York is not one of them. So I think it's a very involved way of doing research that we're not currently doing. But through the Center of Disease Control, they are able to give statistics on each state. So just to clarify, too, about the Congressional Spouses Group, one of the things that the group focuses on are the areas are, as we discussed, a military service and veterans, Native Alaskan and American Indians, high school and college education, as well as seniors. And in the symposiums that were going to be provided, which we already had General Graham come and speak to some spouses in D.C. when they when they were in town in June, in that meeting where he spoke and to make the congressional spouses aware of the issue, and they were given a packet. And any spouse who's a part of the congressional spouses group is given a packet on the statistics in their own state. And then as they go to each symposium, they can share the information they want, whether it be an op-ed piece, whether it be a public service announcement, whether it be, as we're doing right here, talking about the issue, whatever's comfortable for them, as well as contacting the chapter in their area to do things with them, such as the walk, which is being held. One of the walks is October 6th in Hudson. Out of the Darkness is the walk. And so different ways that the spouses, if to participate, you know, and you know, we don't want to, I don't want to, it's not something you want to overload the spouses with, because they have obviously lots of responsibility. But I can see the response of the spouses to this group. Those who can't attend want the information sent to them. Nope. People want to be a part of helping people. And that has been, we already have 40 on, you know, so people can do what they can. And I know people are interested in helping this cause. So.
Now, I have to say to all of you, it seems to me that, first of all, I want to address, there are some cultures, some countries, where suicide is more prevalent than in others. Some of the countries which, you know, have wide social service nets have amazing rates of suicide. And I'm always interested in that. The second thing is, I had a secretary, I think about her all the time, way back in the day, and she lost her wonderful husband. And I would have constant talks with her on the telephone. She was down in New Jersey and I was up here. And she would tell me about, she just didn't want to go on. She had been with this spouse, for a wonderful man, for all of these years. Life had lost its meaning for her. She just wanted out. Now, she didn't suicide, but it sounded to me as if she was so incredibly unhappy, crying and everything else, that it was not something that wasn't a possibility, A, and B, that a lot of other people who had spent 40, 50, 60 years with a spouse might feel the same kind of thing, so that we could have certain indices for when people were at greater risk.
And you're speaking of grief. What she was really going through is grief.
Well, she was going through it for a long time.
And that happens. Yeah. And that happens. And I think those who can carry on, it's finding purpose in their lives. Having a purposeful life, having goals, I think is one of the things that can help someone to carry on when they've lost someone who that dear and that many years of a relationship.
As far as you were wondering about worldwide, in different cultures, the statistic worldwide is 1 million deaths due to suicide per year, which is more than what we lose through wars and homicide combined. So it is a large public health, and there are places where this incidence is greater. I don't know exactly which ones.
Well, I've heard, for example, some of the Scandinavian countries have higher suicide rates than we do.
And there are some Asian countries, too. And one of the things that they've done, again, is restriction of means. So one of the more common, like firearms is the most common means here, poisoning, because of access to like fertilizers and things like that. So they started making fertilizers that were not poisonous, and their suicide rates went down significantly. So means does matter. There is a great program that is Project in New Hampshire, where they are, it's not anti-gun, it's just pro-gun safety. And they have been seeing a decrease in suicides in that state.
Michelle's pointed some things out. There was a study done with the Israeli army, and they were having some issues with increased suicide rates. And when they stopped allowing their service members to go home on weekends with the guns, there was a dramatic decrease in the number of suicides. So I think different countries are looking at different ways to deal with it. Also in China, for example, in this country, more women attempt suicide, but more men complete suicide. In China, more women complete suicide. And again, in reference to what Michelle talked about, a lot of them were ingesting chemical fertilizer. So the Chinese authorities started changing that, and the suicide rates are going down. So I think you know, much like the tobacco control movement, the Alzheimer's movement, the cancer control movement, I think we're going to be spreading our message worldwide that each culture has to figure out what's appropriate and ways to deal with it. I mean, now when my team goes to Capitol Hill and we tell the staff people and their members or their bosses that 37,000 Americans now complete suicide, somewhere around 1.1 million Americans attempt suicide. Alan, guess how many million Americans seriously consider suicide each year?
I don't even want to guess, but I'm sure it's a lot.
Eight million people.
Mm-hmm.
So you roll those numbers up, this is nearly 10 million people are directly impacted by suicide, and it's unfortunately become now the 10th leading cause of death nationwide in this country, and that's not the kinds of numbers we want to have. And unfortunately, or fortunately, it affects all people of all income levels, all parties. This is not something that affects Democrats more than Republicans. And I think, again, our group today really illustrates the whole need for us to move across the country and talk about this like we are in your talk show, and educating people about the warning signs, and then again, letting them know where they can go to get help.
Now, Michelle talked about stigma before, and I'm wondering, has anybody done a study which does comparisons, for example, suicide versus other mental illnesses versus cancer versus, in terms of whether there is more stigma around suicide than any of these other categories?
I mean, I know, Alan, for example, that there are now more studies being done. People who are suffering with a chronic illness, whether it be cancer or diabetes or heart disease, are in fact more times depressed and aren't able to cope with their chronic disease. So they're more apt to consider or complete suicide. So our group, for example, is now reaching out to those organizations, and we're trying to educate them about the warning signs. So again, that we can make this a broad-based approach in this country, and to educate people about the warning signs, like I've said, and to find ways to get
John,
help.
John, let me interrupt and ask the three of you, Mary Jo, the congressional wife who has a social work degree and is so sensitive to this, you, John, because you're sitting at the top of the heap down there in Washington, and Michelle Hunt, all of whom can tell us a little bit about what those specific signs that you keep mentioning are. What is it? Is it loss of appetite? Is it lack of self-respect that we see in people? Is it the fact that they can't get out of bed in the morning? What is it that we should be looking for?
It's all of those things, Alan. It's a change from a person's normal mood or behavior, loss of interest or pleasure in activities that they previously enjoyed, simple things like changes in sleeping patterns, appetite or weight, fatigue or loss of energy, decreased concentration or indecisiveness, and then most importantly, them feelings of hopelessness, worthlessness, self-reproach, or excessive guilt. You know, those are the kinds of things that, especially among the military that are coming back now for these poor service members that have been to hell and back in terms of war, there's all kinds of things they're facing. So I think those are some of the clear warning signs. The imminent warning signs of suicide, again, Michelle talked about it from the get-go. You know, if someone's threatening to hurt or kill themselves out loud, that's a major problem. You need to get them help right away. If they are talking or writing about death on Facebook or in email messages, if they're looking to kill themselves, if they don't have weapons and they're looking to get weapons, that's another big sign. And then the other thing is people who all of a sudden start making plans, giving things away, talking about themselves in the past tense, those are clear signs of people that need help.
Interesting. I've been thinking lately about all of those people who go in and kill huge numbers of people and then turn the gun on themselves. I'm wondering whether or not there is not some suicidal, you know, approach that is somehow linked up to aggression against others. Do any of you know about that?
One of our volunteers, Sue Klebold from Colorado, her son was involved in the Columbine massacre several years ago. she talked a little bit about that. And I think, Alan, the other thing that we're pushing for here in Washington, D.C., believe it or not, only $40 million right now is spent by the federal government on research directly related to suicide, you know, what causes it and how to deal with it. You know, that compared with, you know, $3.8 billion for AIDS, which was, you know, obviously very important, had to be done. The billions of dollars that are being spent on cancer research that have led to increased treatment opportunities.
That's interesting. I'm glad you mentioned those points, because it seems to me when the AIDS crisis first hit, there was all kinds of impetus for people to suicide. And I'm wondering whether, as treatment and drug cocktails and things have gotten there, whether or not the suicide rates among those people who contracted AIDS has gone down.
I think it's a great question, something we ought to take a look at. We are reaching out to the LGBT communities because there is some evidence that there are increased rates of suicide among younger LGBT youth. And again, Michelle mentioned that suicide is now the third leading cause of death for people aged 15 to 24. Mary Jo talked about the suicide rates among Native Americans. On some reservations, Alan, suicide rates are 11 times the national average. It's outrageous and astounding, and we've got to stop it.
Just to get back to your question about murder-suicide.
Yeah, Michelle.
You know, I think that there probably is some commonality because it is a violent resolution to a problem. But one thing that I want to emphasize is that suicide is more than twice the rate of homicide. So suicide is a much bigger problem. Although homicide gets, I think, a lot more attention in the media and as far as funding and things like that, and of course it should be a concern. But as John was indicating, we really need to start putting some money and attention behind this as a public health issue. It is more likely to die of suicide than to die of AIDS or homicide.
All right. But if you say twice as much as homicide, that still leaves homicide as being, you know, a terrible thing.
Absolutely, not to minimize that.
Yeah.
But,
yeah,
you know, we do spend a lot of time and a lot of money addressing that, as we should. But we also need to be looking at suicide as being a terrible loss also.
So let me ask you guys about end-of-life issues. I've always been somebody who believes that there comes a point if an individual wants to take their way out, they're too much pain, that they should be allowed to do that. I have a feeling I'm going to get a no on that from you guys.
Well, as a matter of fact, we're looking very closely at that. The state of Massachusetts, in fact, is having a ballot initiative this November.
And I'm voting for it because I live there.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so there's the whole issue of some people call it physician-assisted suicide. Others call it physician-assisted death. Others now call it aid in dying. Our public policy council and our board of directors is looking very closely at the issue. I mean, I think for your listeners right now to understand what we're looking at, as far as we can tell, these are people who have been diagnosed as terminally ill with no hope of recovery, 6 months or less to live. There are people, in fact, that do who are certified to be of sound mind that want to make that decision. I mean, your listeners may know that the states of Oregon and Washington currently have laws on the books. Interesting studies apparently have been completed where people who actually go ahead and get permission to complete a death that way, in fact, don't do it in the end, but sometimes for some patients it's the final sort of punch in the face to their disease. So I think as society gets grayer, you know, all of us are again are above that the 50 plus that we're going to face this issue going down the road. So anticipate a issue brief from our group. It's a real slippery slope issue. I mean, I personally agree with you, Alan, that if I was facing a terminal illness and had no hope for recovery, I would like to have that option. But at the same time, with the slippery slope, we have to be careful as an organization that's committed to finding help for those 90% of people who are suffering from some form of mental illness or a mental disorder, we don't want to give the wrong message out there. So you can imagine this is a really tough topic. And Michelle is on our Public Policy Council, as you told our listeners, and I've been here for 3 years now. Michelle, would you agree that we've had some of the most thoughtful conversation among the members of the Public Policy Council on this topic?
Absolutely. And it has been very spirited, and people have different opinions. I think some of the concerns that have come up is that this doesn't become kind of the fail-safe, that we are pursuing the best palliative care, the best mental health care for people who have terminal illnesses, so that this doesn't become the first choice.
Well, I mean, first choice is, you're right, and it's as you've both said, slippery slope. But if somebody's got ALS and they can, you know, can't move their head, and they want out, it seems to me that that's a pretty good example of why I would be for it. And Mary Jo, I know that you were shaking your head when we were talking about this a little while ago, so you have some problems with this.
Well, I understand that this is a very huge discussion to have. And as you said, it's going to be put in as a poll to be voted on. And then the American people will decide. Personally, I do see it as suicide, but
did you see something, a suicide that should be prevented? In other words, the guy's lying there. I'm sorry for giving you such a hard time. He can hardly move his lips. It's all done. There's no way back. And he wants out.
He's still here.
Does this have to do with religion, or does this have to do with...
I'm about helping lives and keeping lives. And to be a part of this cause is about lives. And every life, everyone is valued.
Okay.
As you can tell, my passion is people. And people getting comforted in whatever pain that they're in. I want them comforted and know that there are people there for them. And resources are so important. And so people knowing they're not alone. So I understand, and it's not like I'm on a march on this. I'm just saying that's just my opinion. And I know we all value people's lives. Not that I'm saying I value more. I'm just saying I feel they're still here, and we need to comfort them while they're here.
What would you think, Mary Jo, if, in fact, the people of Massachusetts, for example, vote in rather large numbers for this out, quick way out, or out? What would you make of that? Sociologically,
she
was going to speak on this.
I am, you know, from the little bit that I have read about this, that a lot of times that it's related to control.
Sure.
People want to have control.
Sure.
So, I think that we are a society, a culture that really values privacy and control of our own lives, and being empowered. So I think that there is, some draw to this as an option, because people imagine themselves in, like, the instance that you were describing, where they would be losing control, and this would be something that would help them have control.
Is that a bad thing?
I believe that everybody has to make their own decision.
Okay.
So I believe in personal choice. But again, I just worry about us not maximizing everything possible to help that person before that choice is made.
And can I step in on this? And just as you're talking about personal choice, I think for those who are the survivors, the family members and the friends, I think it's important for to be very clear that they were not a part of this. I'm talking of whatever form someone takes their life. I'm not talking necessarily the medical piece that we're discussing now, but I'm saying that there's a huge guilt that goes from what I've come across.
Any death, by the way.
Any death, correct. You're right. Suicide has another piece to it, I believe, for family members. And And so it's important for them not to feel that they were responsible, because they're not. If we're speaking personal choice, and it really has to be, I think, emphasized. Don't you agree, Michelle and John, on that?
Okay, Michelle and John, but Alan doesn't agree.
I can tell you that.
I mean, I knew a woman who's passed now, and it doesn't really, you know, affect anybody individually, who had a husband, and I think she drove him to suicide. And, you know, so, you know, the blanket statement that it isn't their fault. In this case, I thought it was their fault, her fault.
I think everyone's allowed to their opinion. This is true.
You know, the issues that surround suicide are very complicated and very involved. And I don't think that it can be just one issue. So I would say that although that might be have been an issue, I don't think that that was likely the only issue.
Yeah, I'm pretty right.
Just, for example, one of the big things in...
Thanks for being open. Broadening his mind always. He's always evolving.
One of the things that have been on our radar is the issue of bullying. And that as being a risk factor. And one of the things that has sometimes been connected in the media and in people's minds is that... young people who die by suicide, have they been bullied? Is that the reason why they took their life? And one of the things that we have found through research is that that is not a cause of suicide. Bullying is not a cause of suicide. It may be a risk factor, but it's not the only issue. The youth are at risk in other ways, and it might be a trigger, but the causal connection cannot be made.
Well, it's terrible, but we're out of time. I can't believe it. I need you guys to go over the contacts that we can use in case anybody ever feels this.
First of all, our website for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention is a great source of information for survivors, for people who are thinking about suicide, for people who just want to be a more educated community member, and that is www.afsp.org. And then also I want to mention again the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That's a 24/7 crisis hotline, and that is 1-800-273-8255. Or you can think about it as 1-800-273-TALK.
And the last thing you want to do is get put on hold when you're calling a suicide prevention line.
There's always one person on the other end. It's not. It's always.
And Alan, if I can add, yeah, sure. When you call that the suicide prevention lifeline, if you press 1 and you're in the military, you'll get connected directly to someone who understands the military culture and has been trained to work with veterans or service members. So it's a really invaluable service that's being done across the country.
Well, I want to thank all three of you, John Madigan, Senior Director of Public Policy with the Suicide Prevention Action Network, USA, a division of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Michelle Hunt is the Chair of the Public Policy Committee of the Capital Region Chapter of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. And Mary Jo Gibson, wife of New York Congressman Chris Gibson, is one of four congressional spouses from across the country who are joining the cause by co-chairing a series of symposia and other events to raise awareness about suicide. Gibson is a licensed clinical social worker and is a crisis intervention teacher. I want to thank all three of you. This is not an easy subject, but I think you're doing a lot of good, and I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at WAMC.org.